Welcome to Writing the Wrong Way, where we talk about how writing works, how writers work, and why the best writers risk being strange. And today we're also talking about how who writers work with. And my guest is Agent Emmy, as we call Emmy around the office or the studio. Not my agent, but my partner's agent. And so we are always like saying Agent Emmy, Agent Emmy.
I feel like such a super spy when you folks call me that. It makes me really happy.
Yeah, on his podcast he mentions that a lot too. And so anyway, Emmy Nordstrom Higdon works for Westwood Creative Artists, is an agent of a number of people. And what Emmy's going to talk to us about today is how to approach an agent more than anything else. Like, and what are some of the sort of mistakes that writers often make when approaching agents? So we can talk about other things as well, I think, but that's sort of like the core, because one, you were just saying that you wanted to talk about that. And I think it's a good topic. I've been waiting for somebody to, want to talk about that precise thing. But also I get a lot of questions from people about agents. I often don't have maybe the best answers because I don't have an agent. Like I've never had an agent, although I don't have anything against having an agent. I just, either haven't had the project for the agent or just haven't had the agent for the project up to this point, So I'm sure that'll change. But my experience with agents is to some degree limited in that sense. Mm-hmm. And so I always like to just go to the source for, answers to questions rather than kind of making assumptions myself. So, so thanks for joining us here. And before we kind of get into the do's and don'ts of approaching an agent and some of the common kind of mistakes writers maybe make, I wonder if we could just touch a little bit on something that I keep thinking about and, kind of saying to people in different ways. Which is often people just ask me that basic question of like, why don't you have an agent?
Right.
Or should you have an agent? Should they have an agent? And it's hard to answer that question, I find, because the answer is very different. Like the reason I don't have an agent isn't necessarily have anything to do with agents and doesn't necessarily have anything to do with whether they should have an agent or not, there's a kind of an answer to that question that people hate, which is the counter question. What do you want?
Absolutely.
And what I like to say about agents or lawyers or publishers or any other professionals that an artist would work with is, the agent can agent better than you, but they don't know what you want. And so there's a limit to like their powers unless you can clarify to them what you want. And that could be what you want in your career. It could be what you want in this for this project. It could just be what you want in deal terms. It's really hard for there's assumptions that sometimes people make about one another when they're working together in a professional relationship. And I find that writers are often very unclear with what they want, either to themselves or to their agents.
And sure.
So I'm curious to know, one, how do you get to the heart of what you kind of the writer wants? Because you are an agent that of the ones I've talked to and friends have, you are one that kind of has spent more time on this with I remember when I connected you with Gregory, he was mentioning to me a little bit about your early interactions of kind of negotiating, where are you going to work together and so on.
Right.
And he was saying he was very impressed that you were kind of asking him what he wanted and trying to get at his goals and his get some clarity on what he does. And he felt like it was a very personalized approach that you were taking compared to other agents he had talked to in the past and then decided not to go with. And so I'm always just kind of curious about one, how do you just kind of approach that initial kind of figuring out what this writer wants?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And how does that matter to how you work?
Right.
And then maybe from there we can flow into how does a person kind of make clear what it is that they want when they're approaching an agent, and what are some good and bad ways to do that?
Yeah. Honestly, I'm probably the first agent to tell people that having an agent isn't for everybody. I think that I really love my job, and I think that having an agent can be super valuable depending on your goals, but it's definitely not, you know, I wouldn't say that it's a hard and fast need for all authors to have an agent for sure. I think, first of all, like a healthy publishing ecosystem needs to have authors who are self-publishing, authors who are publishing with indie presses, and then authors who are publishing with more traditional presses. And one of the big things I think that a lot of authors don't realize is that different agents have different specialties, first of all. So I work with a number of people who do publish with independent presses and also with traditional kind of like the multinational larger presses. But there are some agents who only work with the bigger companies or the bigger publishers. And there are some agents, again, who sort of have like a genre niche or like a format niche. So they'll only work with graphic novelists, or they'll only work with sci-fi fantasy, or they'll only work in romance, like that kind of those kinds of distinctions. And then also age categories is a big one. So, you know, I think we'll primarily talk about writing for adults, but there are some agents as well who only work with children's books, or who only work with adult books, or fiction, nonfiction. There's all kinds of like kind of arbitrary distinctions that agents make in their work. So yeah, the first thing that people need to know is whether or not the agent that they have is able to kind of have the network that they're looking for in terms of where they would like to sell their books, because that's the primary role that an agent plays. So the first thing obviously is to know where you'd like your books to be. But once you kind of have your own goals in your mind and where you'd like to see your books and what kinds of kind of, I talk about comp titles, but mostly in terms of like what kinds of books you'd like your book to share the shelves with. So for example, I haven't done a huge number of sales in like specifically like hard science fiction or like epic fantasy. Those are not strong suits of mine. Editorially as well, like I'm a really hands-on editor with my clients, and like I really love reading those genres, but I wouldn't say I specialize in editing them. So I tend not to work with authors who write only in those genres, because that's not my strength. That said, like if an author works in multiple genres, sometimes that's okay, because if we can find the right fit for one project, that's different than trying to build a career entirely in one genre or entirely in like one sort of niche. Whereas some agents prefer that. I tend to work with authors who hop around a little bit more and who kind of do. I have some authors who write in multiple age categories or who are interested in both fiction and nonfiction, that kind of thing. So yeah, I think especially for authors who are really interested in self-publishing and have like a knack for marketing themselves and all of that kind of thing, you know, finding printers, all of those like logistical elements that are involved in self-publishing, I think that like an agent is essentially useless to them. You know, if you have all those skills, you don't need a big publisher to back you, and you don't need like an agent to get messy with your work. For independent authors, I would say that it's like a little bit more of a gray area. I know some authors do so well on their own, unrepresented, working with even some of the larger independent presses, and a lot of them do take unsolicited submissions. So if you have sort of the strength to be able to, and the time and energy and all of that, to be able to pitch your book successfully, and you have other people you can consult with on your contracts, or you feel confident doing that yourself, then it's not really a necessity. It's more of a preference. And especially for those people, it's important to know that your agent is willing to do independent contracts, because some agents won't. They'll only do kind of the bigger corporate publishers. So that's a really essential question to ask when you're getting to know an agent. And then for people who want to work with the large multinational publishers, unfortunately, it's sort of like an institutional necessity to have an agent. And I would say like that's not only because the publishers tend to sort of gatekeep by not accepting submissions directly from authors, but also for the sake of the contract. You know, like a lot of independent publishers, I see their contracts are like, you know, 7 to 10 pages long. The terms are pretty clear and like fairly easy to understand. But once you're negotiating with like Penguin Random House or something like that, you're looking at like a 30 page legal document. So having someone who understands not only like the legal jargon, but also sort of the industry standards and has a boilerplate in place can be like a huge benefit. So yeah, I would say whether or not you want an agent depends on where you see your book fitting in, and not all books fit in all places. So that's sort of a, I feel like an introspective talk to have with yourself before you approach an agent to represent your work.
How do you feel that talk? How does the talk usually go though? Initially, like when you're actually kind of talking to, when let's say somebody has submitted to you, Let's just kind of bring right to the nuts and bolts of the kind of
For sure.
topic here. So let's say I'm a writer. So first, like myself, okay?
Yeah.
I'm a person who does some self-publishing projects where I'm going out and printing things myself and so on and so forth. I'm a person who works with independent publishers as well, not self-publishing, but working with kind of
Totally.
I would say mid to large size independent publishers. And then I'm a person who has projects coming at me. Like I can see down the pipe and I can see like a couple projects that are coming
For
where I'm
sure.
going to go towards like a multinational large publisher. So to this point, I haven't really felt the need for an agent. Although I would haven't been averse to one,
Right.
but I've also, I want it to be a scenario where they're it's also worth their time.
Yeah,
Like it's
totally,
not
for
really worth their
sure.
time for the projects I'm doing right now, just because they're slower burn things.
Totally.
Or it's feels like comics where often agents don't have as much use in that arena. But I can see down the pipe, I'm going to
For
hit on
sure.
a couple of large projects. So at that point, I'm going to actually, the one agent that I did get very close to possibly being representing me, it literally wrote to me and said, this is great. I would love the represented project. He goes, to be honest, I'd just be wasting your time. He's like, it
Yeah.
sounds like you've got it all lined up. And, all I would do is come in and take money from you at this point.
Yeah, for sure.
He's like, unless you got another project in the wings that would work. And I didn't. So
Yeah,
he was very good
absolutely.
about that. But like most people aren't that transparent and honest in the publishing industry necessarily.
Yeah,
Although they can be, they
unfortunately.
cannot be, right? But anyway, so I'm looking. So let's say, this project comes down the pipe and I'm going to go, approach an agent.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whether I'm, a person with track record like myself, or whether I'm a newer person. So first off, is there a different way to approach that based on whether I've got the track record or don't?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I would say, and for most agents, I don't know that the track record matters too much, but it's always nice to know when people have experience. For me personally, like, I mostly ask about experience so that I can have a sense of like what it would be like to work with that person. So because I do editorial work with my clients before we take the books out on submission, it's good for me to know whether people have like collaborated on editorial before, especially. That's always my like biggest question mark, because it can be such, I mean, honestly, the one that's the hardest is when it's a really tough emotional process for people, when they haven't had that like experience of having critique that's been challenging, or maybe they have, but like from a friend or from like someone they really trust, and all of a sudden I'm this stranger marching in and like their manuscript is coming back to them like filled with track changes, and they're like, whoa, like what is happening here? So I like to know people's experience more because of that. But of course, like selling a book to a big publisher, they do want to know that people have, if they have a sales record, that they, how they got there and what it is that, what kind of community support they have and all of that kind of stuff. So, I mean, some of that stuff are things, or some of those figures, I would say, are things that we would include in like a proposal or a pitch. The rest of it is just to know kind of like where we're at in terms of a starting point, because I've worked with authors who are like brand new, have never gotten feedback before. But of course, I'm going to approach that process a little bit differently than with someone like you, who's used to like working with multiple people and having lots of hands in the pot. So yeah, it's more so to determine like, all right, where would our starting point be? Like, what would this be like for both of us?
So to bring it close to the topic here, what are the mistakes you see people making in this particular arena with either explaining or refusing to explain perhaps their track record?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so people, I get asked all the time about query letters, right? Like people, there's such a like fervent discourse around query letters these days. I don't know what it is, but it's almost like people think that if they put a comma in the wrong place in their query letter, like that's going to be the be all end all. And that's just not the case. I mean, in terms of experience, I like to see a bio in a query letter, because that's going to be helpful to know kind of where people are coming from, and also like just who I'm talking to. I mean, that's most of the point of a query letter, because I'm going to read your writing either way, right? So it's nice to know like, why do you want this? Like, where are you going with this project? Like, what made you come out and think like, okay, this is the one that I'm going to try and get an agent for? And so like that's kind of what I like to see in a query letter in terms of the experience and things like that. And for a lot of people, honestly, it's more of a conversation than people think. Like if I read the writing and I think it's great, my first email back isn't just going to be like, okay, send me more of your writing. Like I also need to know more about you as a person and like what it is. Could we be good collaborators? Like, would we work well together? Do I have kind of the editorial network you're looking for? Because otherwise, like reading your whole book, it might be fun for me, but it's a waste of your time. So I think that that's where the experience part really comes in terms of the approach, is that conversation of like, okay, like if you've done all these things before, like what is it that you want to do differently now that I could help you with or not?
Now, let me just flag something you said. So you mentioned, people overinvest in the query letters. So one, I think that's an excellent point. I often like, the online discussion about query letters makes it seem like
So
they'll
intense.
make or break the scenario. Like, oh, someone's going to buy it because the query letter is so great. It's like, I always say to people, like, the only reason that you have that query letter is to convince somebody to look at the manuscript.
100%.
And you're just getting them, you just want them to bounce off that letter as fast as possible. So like it should be short. It should be short. I always like quote Pink Floyd, short, sharp shock.
Yes, exactly.
Just make it a short, sharp shock, and then they're out into the manuscript, ideally, right? And you had mentioned yourself, you're gonna read your writing either way. I wonder if that's always true though. Is there things that people can do in that query to destroy themselves where you're not gonna look at that manuscript?
I would say the only thing that they could really do is either be super, super mean. Sometimes you'd be surprised the things that people write in query letters. If there's something in there that's like a real red flag about how they're addressing me or other agents or other authors, like, yeah, that'll be a bit of a turnoff for me. Because I like ultimately we're collaborating, right, on a book. So, like, I don't really want to work with you if you're going to be super, super competitive and rude towards other people throughout the whole process. And also, more than that, like, am I going to want to hand you off to one of my editorial contacts knowing you're kind of a jerk? So, if there's something in there that I'm like, oh, that's like a really rude thing to say, like, probably that's going to be a red flag. But honestly, other than that, like, the only thing that would really come up in a query letter that I think would be like a hard no would be if it just wasn't what I was looking for. You know what I mean? Like, I'm always surprised how many people send me manuscripts that are over 100,000 words, because I say every chance I'm given that I don't look at them. So if people, like if people read my manuscript wish list and it says, like, do not send me manuscripts over 100,000 words, I will not read them. Like, no matter how you frame it, I'm not gonna read it. Like, so that'll be one of, there are a few like hard no's where like it's very clear that people think they're the exception to whatever it is that I've put out into the world, or that it just isn't, like maybe it's not the exception. It just isn't what I'm looking for at the time or what I'm like representing. And I haven't articulated that well, or they've interpreted it differently, something like that. But other than that, I wouldn't say that there's anything in a query letter that would make me like not read the writing at all.
Now, once you're reading the writing, is there what are some of the big things that you see that make you stop reading? I always think that's the litmus test. I always often talk about Stephen King has this had this. I don't know if he still does it. He used to do this thing where what Stephen King would do is he would print out his manuscript when it was done. He'd put it on his kitchen table for his wife to read, and then she just read it when she got around to reading it. And what I always loved, but what she would do. Is if she, let's say she picked it up and started reading it, and then she put it down and went and did the dishes, he would grab the book, find the page where she stopped reading, and then rewrite it.
Yeah, that's
Because of
so
course his goal
smart.
was just to move everyone forward to the next page, to the next page, to the next page, and that became, of course, the hallmark of King's style.
Yeah,
So I always think
absolutely.
about like whether there's a rational reason or not, like why are they putting it down? Why do you stop reading? So you may or may not have rational reasons for, I'm assuming you have rationalizations as to why you're stopping reading. But like, what are some of them? What are the things that kind of get you to stop? And you're like, either you're just out of it, whether you're just done with this manuscript or even temporarily you stop before coming back.
So I actually have a document because I spend a lot of time in our submissions inbox, like in general for Westwood. So I help distribute, we all sort of take turns like distributing the queries out to everyone because we just have like a central inbox that everything comes into. And so not only do I manage my own queries, but I also like distribute everyone else's. And then I also sometimes help to make the decisions about like if queries come in and they're not addressed to anyone, like people just sometimes query the agency, then who should they go to? Like, should we look at it? What happens with this like sort of limbo document? So I have a whole bunch of, because we don't use like a query manager system, I have a whole bunch of like form emails that I have like pre-written that I always personalize them, or I try to, but what like easy copy and paste. So one of the biggest things that we get all the time is that people query agents that are closed. That happens constantly. So make sure that you check that the person you're querying actually is like willing and ready to receive the query, because like it's shocking how often people put, it's just heartbreaking to honestly to me, because I know how much work people put into these packages when, you know, they spend an hour like writing this email and like weeks crafting a query letter, and then they send it off and I'm just going to respond with like, sorry, but like this agent isn't open to queries right now. Or people will see that like an agent is only open to queries by referral, and they'll somehow try to like spin their query as though, you know, we should look at it anyway, when like the agent is not going to look at it. Like, I'm sorry, but if they say no, like really means they're too busy. Like they just don't have the time. So that's a big one.
Can you explain quickly what that means? Like why an agent would be closed to submissions? Because I find people don't understand that idea.
Yeah, usually it's because we're too busy, honestly, like for whatever reason. Like it might be personal, it might be business, like maybe they have like a book launch coming up that's just like consuming all of their time and they don't have time to read queries. Those are the reasons why I close temporarily, because I'm a fairly new agent. So in general, I'm open, but there are times where like for 3 or 4 months, like for example, earlier this year, I got bitten by a dog and I couldn't type. Like that was not a good time for me to be looking at queries because I couldn't respond to anyone. So like silly things like that happen. But then also, you know, sometimes if I have a client, for example, who's working on a book and for whatever reason, say the editorial process is like very intense and we're going back and forth on, you know, like small details, or like I did a cookbook earlier this like that came out earlier this year. And there was so much back and forth during the production of that book about, you know, photos and color temperatures and the cover. And because it was a 4-color book, there's so much more that goes into the production aspect than for like a normal prose book where we like might have a couple of exchanges over the cover. But those sorts of things that just like take up a lot of time. But there are some agents that are just like fully closed, or who are closed like more long term. And that's usually because their list is full. Like if they can only, you know, like some of the agents who I work with have been in the business for like 30 years. They have like 100 clients on their list. They have an assistant, they have them. And then like just the volume of work is too much, you know, to be able to sort of take on new people or read new things, because their current clients are constantly sending them new work. They're negotiating deals on their behalf, that kind of thing. And so sometimes they might consider someone new if it's someone who's brought to them by a current client or by like a colleague that they really trust. But generally speaking, they're not going to be looking at adding new authors to their roster. And most of the time, it wouldn't be fair if they did, because they wouldn't really have time to support them well enough to help them to develop their careers. So that's those are like the most common reasons I can think of why people would close.
So what are some of the other big no's that you end up giving out to people, and why?
Yeah, so one that comes up all the time, and especially among authors who do have fingers in multiple pots, like self-publishing and indie publishing, is when a book has already been published. So I know that we, like Gregory, who is a client of mine, we talk all the time about this, because it's like, it's such contentious space.
Yeah, we always discuss this idea and how ridiculous we think it is, but it is, you are correct though. It is a thing that will kill a deal in traditional publishing often, whether it should or not.
Exactly. And the rationale for it is kind of backwards of what people think, because what happens all the time is that we'll have authors who come to us who have written, let's say a novel for the sake of argument, because it's a little bit different with graphic books or comics or illustrated works. But for argument's sake, let's say a novel, they've written it, they put it out on, you know, like Amazon self-publishing or something like that, or even like Wattpad, but like any online platform where people are like, sometimes it's like pay to play and sometimes it's free, but like where people are reading their book and being counted for reading it, and they'll be like, I got, you know, like X number of readers for this book, it definitely needs a better home. You know, there's obviously a proven audience for this. Or even sometimes it'll be people who've like taken things. I know that like there are a lot of people who take things that they've self-published to conventions and things like that. And they'll be like, this sells so well at conventions and blah, blah, blah. People think that what I can do then as an agent is like take those impressive numbers and like take them to a publisher and be like, look, this is amazing. Obviously, there's an audience for this book. It's going to sell really well. But actually, what publishers see is like, okay, that audience has already been saturated, or there's a piece of that pie that's been taken already. I'm never going to be able to sell this to my marketing team. And so you might like, there are. I will say that there are exceptions to this, obviously. One of the big ones has been TikTok, honestly. Like, that's been like, TikTok has been such a weird addition to the publishing landscape. I don't know where it's going. I don't really understand how it's working, but there have been a few books, several books that have been self-published that have gone viral on TikTok, and publishers have jumped on them and republished them right away. But that's not something you can engineer for yourself, just to be clear. Like, you cannot pop your self-published book on TikTok and be like, okay, all of a sudden, and you know, billions of people want this book, and I'm going to bring it to Tor, and they're going to be like, great. Tor like handpicks those books. It's very rare that like you can make that happen for yourself. The other thing that like does sometimes happen is that, you know, especially in genres like romance or science fiction, fantasy, like more genre quote unquote categories, there are publishers who are open to seeing books, especially that have been revised or that were published a long time ago that had like kind of a cult following, and they'd like to bring them back to a wider audience. So those sorts of things do happen. But for most traditional publishers, if a book has been made available at all, I'm going to get like an automatic pass when I send that out. So as an agent, it's a really, really difficult thing to make a case for. Sometimes what we can do is like take a book that's been self-published or something like that out for international rights or translation rights if you have another project that we're going to take out for like a regular submission. So there are some cases, but if you're querying a book that's already been published, it's almost certain that an agent is going to be like, I can't do anything with this for you. I'm really sorry. And just like form email send you away.
My point of view of it on personally is just I think publishers are wrong and it's a
Oh.
bad approach. But I also think that there's no reason you should be self-publishing a book if you want to take a traditional publishers. Like you should have
100%.
done one or the other. And I don't understand why you would switch your plan midstream. Like what I don't like
Yes.
about the idea is that you're changing your plan partway through, which
Totally.
suggests that you didn't have a good plan in the first place. Now I know for
Yeah.
some people that's there's good legitimate reasons why you might do it. And as you say,
Yeah,
the graphic
totally.
novel space or the comic book space is very different.
Totally different. Yeah.
But it is one of these things where I think, while I don't think publishers are right on this count, I do kind of understand the
Yeah.
logic of, well, it seems like that person doesn't know what they're doing on a certain level.
Yeah.
And they're approaching us now, asking us a question that we're going to tell them no to. Like, so I feel like there's like a bit of a self-fulfilling aspect where it kind of just, I think, and again, ultimately, I don't like that attitude that publishing has about it, but I
Totally.
understand where it comes from and why it's kind of there a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's honestly, to me, it reflects like a lack of understanding in publishing about the internet landscape. Like
Yes.
that, I think publishing traditionally just like doesn't have a great grasp as to like what publishing online means as a litmus test for interest, or even publishing physically into like a small community. But regardless, like I haven't seen it change yet, at least for prose. I will say that for graphic novels, it's becoming quite different. I think that publishers who publish, especially comics and graphic novels, like they have, I think, a bit more of a forward-thinking business model in general, and they tend to like wrap their heads around the digital landscape a little bit better because they've seen how well web comics can translate into published works. But I don't think that prose publishers have caught up to that at all.
So what are the other big problems that you end up hitting in a manuscript?
Yeah, so something that happens all the time for me, like I said, is the word limit. I won't dig into that except to say that it really is just a cost question with publishers. They can't publish enormous hardcover books like they used to and have them be affordable. So that's I mean, I as much as I explain it, I know that people want to write 500,000 word books. So like I understand the draw, but as a debut author, I would always just encourage people to try and keep it like compact and also standalone. It gives you your best chance at being published, even if that sucks, which I understand that it does in many cases. That's sort of where we are with like the publishing climate the way that it is. For me personally, oh sorry,
Can
yes.
we just unpack that real slightly?
Yeah.
Like, I think what people often don't understand about that is because people look at the shelves and they see series, series, series. They see these big, thick series books and they think, well, that makes no sense. Publishers are obviously publishing this. But I think what you make a good point though, that like when we're talking to a debut author, two things that those authors don't really think a lot about, although is from the publisher's point of view, they got to print these books, and printing the books involves paper. And it involves shipping the paper. And if you've got a book that's that thick or a book that's that thick, you can put like twice as many of these in a box.
Yes, totally.
And it's the same weight as like half as many of these. And that makes a massive difference. People don't think about just the logistics of what publishers are under. Never mind, as you say, like whether they're in for multi-books or not. There's so many logistical things that I don't know that writers need to understand necessarily, but they don't understand it. And because they don't understand it, I think sometimes they are confused, like why publishers do certain things or what their attitudes are. But you got to understand, just if you're out there thinking about like your book, just literally think about, I would really encourage writers, even who don't intend to self-publish, I would encourage them to just go a little bit down that path. Like call up a printer and quote, imagine your book is, you know, like quote it out. Imagine you're going to publish it and go get a quote and see how much it costs to print that 1,000 copies of that book.
Oh,
and you'll start to get a sense of like how much, imagine you were spending that money rather than the publisher. And imagine you had to make a case to yourself for spending the money. Could you do it?
100%. I mean, honestly, like I've had this conversation with editors, especially when I first started out, because I didn't understand either. I was, you know, I would sometimes go to people and I would ask them their preferences for what it was that they were looking for. And, you know, at least as a new agent, you get like the luxury of being like, why is that? Like, or I mean, people you have a good relationship with too. Sometimes I am like, why are you looking for that? Like, that's weird, you know? And one of the things that I heard all the time was that they were looking for shorter books. And it feels very counterintuitive, you know, because as a reader, you would think like, exactly. You walk into a store, you see like 15 of a series of some things, and readers can't get enough of them, you know? So why are publishers looking for books that are short and standalone when readers clearly have like a voracious appetite, right? But that is, it often comes down to paper costs. Like it's, especially since 2020, I could talk about this all day, but there was a law that passed in China that was basically an environmental regulation that shut down a whole bunch of paper mills. And people don't necessarily compute either that, like, when we talk about paper, like, we're talking about everything from like the box that your Amazon package comes in to like the special edition book that you're ordering from Subterranean Press for, you know, $150 or whatever or more. But like, all of that paper comes from the same place, right? And so, as ordering and shipping and those kinds of demands go up, and as the population grows, we have like really basic paper needs, like paper towel and boxes and those sorts of things. Books are a luxury product. And so, especially in North America, where books have always been seen as like a luxury object, we've used all kinds of different kinds of paper to make books over the years. And that range is, first of all, getting much smaller, like as in terms of what's available. And also it's becoming like just much harder and more expensive to get the base materials. So right now there is a, like with the machinery that we use to make books, to make a hardback book, basically like the top length that a publisher wants to do is 400 pages, because once you go past that, it's like a different mechanical process that's required to make the book, and it costs much more. So let's say the cutoff is like around 400 pages. How much does it cost to buy a 400 page hardback book? Like, and especially in Canada, I think we're acutely aware of this because you get like the books that have the US, you know, price on them and the Canadian price on them. If it's a $35 book or a $40 book in the US, anywhere else in the world, it's going to be like $45, $50 to buy. already you're setting yourself up for failure as a debut author. How many people are going to be able to afford to buy that book, let alone read it and bump the sales up and review it, get it on TV, get it in the newspaper, like all of those things in terms of the time investment required. So yeah, like it's really, really basic logistic questions sometimes that mean that like when you send me an email and you're like, no, really, my book really is worth 101,000 words, like I'm still going to pass because it means that you're just not listening to what the industry that you're trying to break into is saying to you. And that's a huge problem.
And they're throwing, and people don't understand, like the model is they're throwing spaghetti at a wall and they're seeing what spaghetti sticks. And it, they don't want to throw $100,000 spaghetti at the wall.
No.
They'd rather throw $20,000 spaghetti.
Exactly.
Then if that, hey, if that sticks, sure, we'll throw $100,000 at it next time. You know, and then maybe we're into like a five volume deal or whatever, you know?
Yeah, 100%. They still happen. It just doesn't usually happen for debut authors. That's
my friend just got one. But yeah. At the same time, it's not her first book.
Yeah, we did a deal in 2022 at Westwood for six books for one of our like super established authors. Like that doesn't come along very often. But like, if you are an author who's trustworthy and churning out books and the publisher knows you can write quickly and you're reliable and all of those things, like, yeah, 100%. But they don't know that when it's your very first novel. They just know that it's possible you spent your entire life writing this one book and you might not have another book in you. You might not have goals to write other books or whatever. Or even if you do, life might happen and things might change for you. So you need to really establish yourself as a professional in the industry before they're going to invest that kind of money in your work.
My daughter's reading for an indie publisher here, like doing just kind of reading the slush pile for him.
I love that.
And she was kind of having a hard time. She's like, well, what would I do with this? She's like, I'm reading some of these things. She goes, it's like, I don't know how I feel. Like, yeah, it's good, but I don't know how good is it. I said to her, well, think about it this way. I go, are you going to turn around and tell that guy to spend $40,000 on it?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, would you spend $40,000 on it? Like, so some stuff is really good. But is it that good?
Exactly. And that's why when agents say like, it's not the right fit, or like, it just didn't have that like sparkle for me or something like that. Like sometimes it's true. The query can be great and your writing can be great. But like, if I just don't feel passionately about it, like, am I going to spend the next year of my life working on this book that like might not go anywhere? Like you really have to feel strongly that like what you're working on has potential. You know what I mean?
I always think about when I used to be in music. There was a guy I met, some guys I kind of knew. They got signed by Chad Kroeger's label in conjunction with another label, a larger label, like Kroeger's label is on, kind of thing. And so the big producer for that, for Roadrunner Records, was in town. And I was talking to him and I was saying, hey, I go, he was the guy who signed Nickelback. That was one of his recent claims to fame. And I asked him, I said, you know, no offense to Nickelback, I go, but they're not the best band. I go, so explain to me, like, why did you sign Nickelback? And he said to me, he goes, look, he goes, he's like, you're right. He goes, he's like, obviously, I think they're a good band. He goes, and I wasn't going to sign them because they kept sending me their tapes and all this stuff. And I'm like, yeah, it's good. He goes, but, you know,
yeah,
it wasn't really my thing exact as much as other stuff. You know, is it $1 million good? But Kroeger kind of got on him, like, come see a show, come see a show, come see a show. So finally he's like, you know, I got a layover in Vancouver when they happen to have a show.
Right.
Because if you pick me up at the airport and drive me to the show, I'll watch a show as long as you drive me back to the airport.
Right.
So he does this. And he said, when he's on the, so Kroeger picks him up. As they're driving to the venue, a Nickelback song comes on the radio. They get to the venue. The doors are closed. There's a line around the block.
Right.
To waiting to get in. Because then he watches a show. You know, he cabs it back to the airport. Another Nickelback song comes on the radio. And he said, he goes, yeah. He goes, so I got home and I signed Nickelback. He's like, but that's kind of, he goes, at this, he goes, earlier today, because he's just walking around Winnipeg. He goes, earlier today, he goes, I was on the street and I heard a guy playing guitar. He goes, that guy is better than Chad Kroeger.
Right.
He goes, I gave him $20. He was so good. He goes, I could have given him $1 million though.
Yeah.
He's like, but you know, I don't know if the other stuff is in place. Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. In the publishing sort of challenge that we're facing right now as well, that's, I hate the word unprecedented. I have really come to loathe that word, but that at least in recorded history in North America, is unprecedented, is that 75% of book sales right now are backlist, like from
Yep.
the, normal, like traditional sales channels. So like book brick and mortar bookstores, Amazon, like that kind of stuff. And if you are a brand new author that has no backlist, that means that like already authors who have a book out have a 75% sales advantage over you. So publishers who are like in the past have been more willing to take risks on new artists who maybe don't have all those like little bits and pieces in place already, are looking at other authors who, like, they might not be the best authors out there, but they have a sales record and they have something that they can build on, and that's becoming like more and more and more appealing. So it makes it really, really difficult if you've never traditionally published a book, because people can come with like even a modest sales record, and right now chances are good statistically that that's going to grow over time. Whereas in the past, people used to be way more invested in front list books, like new release books. And so if you came with something like new and special and amazing, like that actually gave you a huge advantage over even people who were selling older titles. So that shift, and that happened, like we publishing knew that was coming, but it got increased exponentially by the pandemic, when people like discoverability of books changed because people weren't seeing things on shelves. So new releases were like flying under the radar. And then also by TikTok, where people, like book reviewers who are going viral, they're not necessarily reading a brand new book. They're probably reading something that they got from the library or from Barnes and Noble or whatever that they bought 4 years ago and has been sitting on their shelf for a while. And so those books are getting like a whole new life, which is exciting if you have a backlist, and extra challenging if you do not.
Did you ever get this, Emmy? Hi, I'm ready to submit. I need an agent. I'm the next J.K. Rowling,
All the time.
right?
Like once a week.
So,
100%.
in addition to now, I know that's more of a query letter thing, but like, obvi like, why do you think people do that kind of? On one level, they're doing something correct, which is providing comps, right?
Yes, totally. Always provide a comp.
But like, obviously, it's kind of in a diff. The ba a wrong-headed way. Where do you see stuff like that in a manuscript where it's like they're just doing, it's like maybe they're doing something right, but they're kind of doing it the wrong way in a manner of speaking, or they're just kind of not quite hitting the all cylinders. Like, what are some of the other things that you're just kind of, you keep seeing where you're like, I wish I could, this was a different way.
Yeah, structurally is a huge question, because one of the things that's really, really tough is that a lot of authors will have read heavily books that were published like 10, 15 years ago, which is awesome. Like, I have no qualms with older books, and absolutely, I think it's great that people are widely read. You know what I mean? Especially if you're writing in a particular, like if you're targeting a particular audience, like domestic thriller, like, yes, read every domestic thriller that you can get your hands on. But people don't necessarily realize how quickly book tastes shift. And so, if you're not reading the newer titles that are coming out, which were acquired 3, 4 years ago now, you're really not going to know kind of where publishing is headed in terms of reader expectations and publisher expectations. So, that happens all the time. And the way that it often manifests right now, I'm finding, is that people don't realize. So when you, I laughed when you were talking about Stephen King and how his like really immersive style of storytelling became kind of a staple of his. That's really become a staple of publishing over the last few years, especially where, like, I think it has a lot to do with streaming becoming like television streaming becoming so much more popular, because people have access to such a huge amount of media that books are really expected to, I mean, they're just another form of media, right? So in some senses, they're really expected to compete with video games and movies and all of that kind of stuff. Obviously, not all books are like that. Like, there's a whole thing of literary publishing where slow, quiet books like really find their place in the world, and that's
I
all
like to call
fine.
books anti-social media. It's my
Exactly. Yes. But there are definitely certain genres, especially things like if you're writing a book that's meant to be a beach read or meant to be commercial or meant to be like adventure or thriller, those kinds of books, like you really need to compete with the pacing that you're seeing in other places. And so what I see so often is people will send in like their first, we usually ask for like the first 10 pages or something like that as a writing sample. It's a short amount anyway, but it's usually from like the top of your book. And what I see so often is that people will start a book with like a huge amount of exposition. And that was incredibly popular, like I would say like in the late 90s, like early aughts. But these days we don't really start with exposition. Like most books will start with like an inciting incident or like a propulsive plot point or a really like immersive action-filled scene, because it is this thing about distraction, right? We're picturing people consuming books in all kinds of ways. So audio, like adaptations, e-reading, all of these things where people are reading in like little snippets in the middle of like an otherwise really busy day, and they're being pulled in all kinds of different directions, right? And so what you really need is for people to pick up that book and not want to put it down. And that's like that writing sample at the beginning, it needs to not be exposition. Like it needs to not be like someone starting their day or like us getting like a long backstory. Like usually it needs to be these days something that's really going to hook people like right from the beginning. And you get a little more leeway as your book, you know, as people get invested in the book. Probably 10 chapters in, they're not going to like close the book and walk away because you're telling me what your character had for lunch. But that's not true of the first page. They absolutely will. So I would say that that kind of flip of structural expectations has really changed in a short period of time. And that's something I see a lot of as well. It's not necessarily something that I'll pass on a book for as long as the content is there, but I'm definitely going to like tell people that their book is like a bit of a puzzle and we're going to like have to break it up and like put it back together again.
What's the line? I mean, it's kind of abstract, but is the what's the kind of line where you're it kind of divides a book that you'll work to improve versus one you won't?
That's such a good question. For me, this is going to be different for every agent. I should qualify this answer because I really like doing editorial work, and our agency is quite small and hands-on. So I get a lot of leeway in terms of what I'm able to take on. That's not true of all agents. And also, some agents just don't like doing that editorial work. Like, they'd rather just sign things that are like sales ready. Typically the books that like I'm willing to put elbow grease in on are ones where I think that the story is something that like people really need to hear and that I haven't seen before. So often it's like a values judgment for me. I won't usually work really hard on a book that I'm like, for example, if it's just like a really cute rom-com, I'm like, there are 8 billion really cute rom-coms. I'm not gonna spend like 6 months like, you know, like crowbarring this into shape with somebody, unless I feel like the author hasn't had access to the information they need to be able to get it to the place where it should be. Like, if they just don't know that there are genre conventions that they're missing, and I think they're capable of doing that work, then sometimes I might consider it. But if somebody sends me something that's like really fascinating and interesting, or about like maybe some social issue or something like that, that I feel like I haven't seen in books before, or they're writing from a place that I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. Like, your experience is not something I've seen explored. Like, those are the kinds of books that I'm like, okay, this might not be perfect, but like, I think we're getting there. Or alternately, if the writing blows me out of the water, like really, really good writing, but like people just don't, like, maybe the author doesn't have a grasp on like the industry expectations, or like, there just needs to be that, like, okay, we're gonna like break this down scene by scene and just like put them in different places, like that kind of work. If the writing is like really, really amazing, I'm a sucker for that.
No, this is really useful and helpful, I think. What else, before I let you go, I don't want to take too much of your time. Can we maybe hit just one or two other little things where it's like just unique to you? What I like to call your bugbears. What's your bugbear? People
Yeah,
don't like,
totally.
my daughter's always making fun of me for saying bugbear,
I love
but I still like
bugbear.
that. But yeah, what's your sort of bugbear where it's like maybe it's just you,
Yes,
but
totally.
it's, you know, a thing that drives you nuts in these queries or in these submissions.
Yeah, so I have a few of them. One of them is, so grammar is always important. I think people underestimate the value of good grammar in their book, just generally overall, because it really is for agents and editors a measure of how much work you're going to have to do on the book in a lot of ways. I'm always doing the mental math when I'm reading a sample of like, okay, how much would I have to copy edit this for it to be acceptable to go to an editor? And do I think that author could do it on their own, or would I be doing that? Like, because it's a ton of work to do. If especially like, for example, that comes up a lot if you're writing in a language that isn't your first language sometimes. Like sometimes it's super worth it, but sometimes you just have to get somebody else to copy edit it. You know what I mean? So anyway, that's like my spiel on grammar. But my personal pet peeve is when people start sentences with coordinating conjunctions. I hate it with like a passion. It's become super trendy because if done tactfully and like with restraint, it can be kind of voicey. And I think that in some genres, like the YAH category, rom-coms specifically, it's used more than not to make things feel conversational and casual and that kind of thing. But I think that authors see that in published books and they think like, oh, I can just write the way that I hear things in my head and not the way that grammar actually works. And it makes it extremely awkward for someone else to read. So I constantly, even with my clients, am going through manuscripts, erasing like, but, then, and from the beginning of sentences. And you'd be shocked how often you can just get rid of it and the sentence still makes perfect sense. And it still conveys what you want it to convey, but it doesn't feel like every sentence you're writing is a sentence fragment, which drives me up the wall. I literally tell people that I'm allergic to sentence fragments. And after a while, if they do it a lot in their manuscripts, in like a teasing way, I'll just send my clients like a sneezing emoji rather than writing anything. Like that's what they'll get as the comment, is like a sneezing emoji, because I'm like, I'm so tired of this. And they know that it drives me nuts, but like, it's just one of those things that people do stylistically these days. The other thing is first pages. I don't think people ever pay enough attention to their first page. I think people think that like, if they've edited it 20 times, it must be good. But I would challenge people to like, if you think it's done, like give it a couple days and do it again.
I really recommend to people, there's an agent in the US called Noah Lukman, and Noah Lukman has written a series of books on like editing and writing. And he has this great book called The First 5 Pages. And that's what it is. It's just like how to rewrite your first 5 pages. Like the idea, of course, being that you'd carry that out through the rest of it. But he goes into detail about like, look, from the point of view of an agent, like here's how important those first 5 pages are. And here's the common mistakes writers make and so on. And of course, you're mentioning some of them.
Yeah. Well, and people, I think that like it's overblown how good your first couple pages have to be, because it's so tedious. But the reality is like, not only are you querying me with those first couple of pages, but like, that's what I'm going to send to editors too, right? Like, and then they're going to be thinking about like, okay, well, my marketing people are going to be seeing this as the opening to your book. The marketing people are then thinking about like, okay, the super busy, like single mom who's standing in chapters, like opening it up and reading the first couple pages to see if this is the book they're going to pick. Like it never goes away. So I'm so picky about the first page. I always want to see at least the main character, a hint at what the central conflict of the book is going to be. Like, I want to know that right from the first page. And I also want to know a little bit about like what kinds of challenges or like barriers the character is going to face, and also what kinds of advantages they have or like facilitators are on their side. And it's so much to cram into a page, but you have to like, I want it. I have to have it. So I feel like I have sent entire manuscripts back to people and been like, the first page isn't good enough. Do it again.
In screenwriting, it's very common for people, if they get a new script, to look at the first page and look at the last page and then decide if you're going to read the rest.
Yeah. From academic work, that's like my, I know that some agents or readers like consider this to be total sacrilege, but I always read, when I have a full manuscript, I read the first chapter and the last chapter. And then I open to like what I think is roughly the middle, and I read like a middle section. And from there, I've basically decided whether or not I'm going to read the whole book or not.
Now people hate when I say that, what you just said, people are going to react against this. So really quickly, like this is the logic of it. So one, the logic is, is it hooking and drawing interest at the start? Do you want to keep reading? And as you say, that matters for you, that matters for the person you're selling it to, that matters for the person in line at the bookstore, et cetera. But also flipping to the end, the big question is like, did something change?
Yes, exactly. Did you?
It's not just about like, is it a good ending? It's like, well, did the story have significance? Like, was there an actual change that this character went through or the world went through or whatever? Yeah. Because stories, at least traditionally stories, unless you're doing talking about an experimental story where the thesis is that nothing changes and the universe is a nightmare, which
time travel,
you know, don't tend to sell well.
Not like a good strategy. Yeah.
But like for the most part, like books on a fundamental level are about how the belief that the world can change.
Exactly.
And so stories that don't have that movement, there's almost nothing you can do to fix them or make them marketable, at least.
Exactly. Yeah. I want to get a sense of like the arc of the story. So that's like, I'm really impatient as a reader, and I want to know like right from the start what it is I'm going to get from the book. So that's why I always read the opening chapter, obviously. And then the last chapter, I want that like freeze frame at the end where like the hero is standing there like bloodied and beaten. And, you know, like I want to know like where are we going with this, or like what happened, you know? And then I do, obviously the journey matters. So I definitely read some of the middle as well to like get a sense of like how that action is progressing. But if those three things aren't in place on like a basic level, then like chances are good that reading the rest of the book and taking like a week to do it is not going to be a good investment of my time.
Now, before I kind of let you go and we end off here, let me just get one last, what is the one thing that if you see it one more time, your head's going to explode?
Oh my gosh, that's such a good question. Oh, there are a few. I can think of this one query that we've gotten the same query like a million different times. But honestly, I think that the thing that is like unique question mark that people think is unique anyway, is telling us like how much better than some older author they are. Like I'm the next, like you mentioned J.K. Rowling, but we also get like Tolkien, Stephen King, Dan Brown, whatever. Like, I feel like that's a huge misconception. Like, we're not actually looking for the next Gillian Flynn. Like, we have Gillian Flynn, you know? Like, she's done her thing. She's been writing for a long time. I love her books. Lots of people love her books. But, like, I don't want to read her again. I want to read something new and different, you know? And so sometimes formulaic is great. I read a lot of books that are formulaic and I love them. And if that's what you're doing, like, oh, this is for a lover of, like, this trope or, like, this type of book, then that's different to me than trying to be like the archetype of someone else's writing, you know? Like that doesn't make me want to read more of your writing. It makes me want to go pick up Gone Girl again and read it for the first time, you know, or Harry Potter or whatever like magical mystery book you think you're going to give me like the second version of. Like I don't want a second version of that. I like want your interesting new story, you know? So I feel like pitching yourself as, you know, like the combination of things can sometimes be helpful, or like telling me themes, or like having good comps is great. But if that's the only selling point that you're going to give me for your book, like it doesn't make me excited. You know, I want to know what's different and what's interesting about people's stories. So yeah, that's something that drives me crazy.
Well, thanks again so much for talking to me, Emmy. And if you are out there listening and you have a terrible query and a manuscript that you want to send to Emmy Nordstrom Higdon, they are with Westwood Creative Arts.
Yes, absolutely. And I have my personal website is emmy.oo. Emmy, ooh.
Nice.
So people can find all my details there too.
Wonderful. And thanks again for talking to me, and keep agenting the wrong way.
Thank you.